must constantly look at things in a different way.
The Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast was created by two physical therapists out of the desire to learn more about the different educational roles in physical therapy and healthcare, and how healthcare education works by talking with educational leaders and people with different perspectives within physical therapy and across interdisciplinary lines on how education can be improved to disrupt the status quo of healthcare education. This is our journey, and thanks for listening. Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. My name is Brandon Pollan, and I am one of your hosts. And as always, I am joined by my other co-hosts, F. Scott Feel and Daphne Wyrock. And today is actually a very interesting episode and kind of a take that we haven't taken before, is we're actually interviewing one of our own for the podcast tonight, as tonight we're interviewing Stephanie to kind of really talk about kind of the path of the emerging educator and kind of what she's gone through. Now, for those of you who perhaps haven't been aware or perhaps didn't hear the announcement a while back, Stephanie Wyrock has actually joined our team of co-hosts. She joined after CSM of this year. And the reason why we reached out to Stephanie, well, there's a couple. Number one, she's awesome. Number two, she's very heavily involved with a lot of avenues within the profession that F. Scott and I frankly are not. And she's got a perspective that is really valuable and unique that would really help kind of complement the differences that we had. Her personality, and with her being such a go-getter and what she's already done for the profession, in my opinion, has just been truly remarkable. And, you know, I'm actually very humbled to have her joining us in general, because I've definitely learned a lot from her as well. So for those who aren't aware, Stephanie Wyrock is employed currently as a doctor of physical therapy at Rehab Authority in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, but she will soon be moving to Connecticut in the near future. Now, Steph, for our audience who perhaps hasn't heard of you, do you think you could tell our listeners kind of an overview about, you know, who you are, how you got to where you're at today, and kind of what you're looking to do with your career to be an educator?
Yeah, well, thanks for taking the time to interview me today, Brandon. I'm very honored to be a part of the team. That introduction that you gave was very, very kind, and I am very flattered that you said all those nice things about me. I graduated with my doctorate in physical therapy and a master of science in clinical investigation from Washington University in St. Louis. And then I've graduated from University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota with a bachelor of science degree in biology. As you said, I'm very involved in the APTA, especially and within our profession. It's something that I've always really enjoyed ever since I was a student, just being involved in making sure that I'm making a difference, not only at an individual level while I treat my patients, but my main goal is how can I change the profession of physical therapy? How can I impact more than just the patient that's in front of me? And so that's how I really got involved in a lot of the different avenues that I've been involved in. So I've served on a few task force for the APTA. I lobby both at the local, state, and national level. I recently helped Minnesota PT Association write a policy and advocate for a policy to help physical therapists distribute disability handicap stickers in Minnesota. Unfortunately, with how short our legislative session was, we only got through the House. We never got it through the Senate. So that'll be something that we'll have to pick up again next year. And then I've done a lot of speaking across the country, both through the APTA and through other avenues. I talk a lot about social media use, generational issues, and organizational membership. And then I manage the social media accounts for the APTA Academy of Physical Therapy Education and PT Day of Service. I've done research in low back pain and have had research grants through the National Institutes of Health. And I have also presented nationally on my research as well. So I've kind of hit all avenues of dedicating my life to improving patient access to physical therapy service, as well as adding to the body of knowledge of physical therapy service. And this is how I became interested in teaching and in educating. I specifically now am involved in clinical education, and I do a lot of clinical teaching, which I really love, and I'm hoping to someday get more involved in educating through a physical therapy program. You had mentioned that I'm going to be moving to Connecticut soon. My husband just matched into a residency at Yale, so we're going to be moving to Connecticut at the end of May, so we're pretty excited about that and excited for the new adventure that is coming. So that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, Steph, you know, your resume is beyond impressive, and I have to echo Brandon's sentiments. We are just so pleased to have you as a co-host on the show. It's really given us a new outlook on the show and a new viewpoint that we really just could not have done without you. So thank you so much for taking your time to be a part of this. You know, we are just so pleased to have you. But, you know, one degree that we really have not talked about yet on this show is the Master of Science in Clinical Investigation. Do you think you can maybe tell us a little bit about the details of that program and, you know, what that entailed and why someone should pursue that degree?
Sure. So the Master of Science in Clinical Investigation was a degree that I obtained through, it's basically a master degree in research is how I like to tell people about it. In PT school, I ended up taking a year off in between my first and second year and dedicating myself to research. So I became a full-time, basically PhD student for a year and took a lot of classes on research design, research methodology, designing research studies, statistics, epidemiology, all those courses that are really important in understanding the literature that you would read as a physical therapist, and also how do you produce really good quality of literature that's going to advance the profession that you're working for, the science that you're working for. And so as far as other schools offering this degree, it's not something that I've seen at a lot of other different institutions, but at Washington University in St. Louis, as a pre-doctoral student, we were allowed to write a grant in which we collaborated with a faculty member at WashU, and I collaborated with Dr. Linda Van Dillon at Washington University in St. Louis, who is well known for her low back pain research. And you submit that grant to the institution, and then the institution picks throughout the entire institution a few individuals that will pursue that degree. Mm-hmm. And the degree was paid for by the grant as well as the classes. And so if you're exploring maybe that you want to get a PhD someday, or you really want to improve your ability to critically analyze the literature to really understand what the literature is saying to you as a clinician or as a potential educator, this is a really great degree to get to kind of preempt, is this something more that I want to pursue? And I have always been really interested in pursuing my PhD, and that's something that I'm looking to potentially pursuing in the future. And this degree has really given me the ability to teach my students who come through our doors at Rehab Authority and teach my colleagues the importance of being able to critically analyze the literature, understand what it's saying, and apply it to your clinical practice.
No, I love that. And, you know, Steph, I'm kind of curious on just one aspect of that. Was that included kind of with your program, or did you guys have to pay separately for that? Just for someone who's maybe thinking about that, or they're kind of hearing this new program and degree here, you know, just from a cost standpoint, what does that generally look like?
So I did not have to pay for the degree. The degree was paid for by the grant. So, I mean, technically I got a free year of school. I did have to go to school for 4 years. So I did my first year of PT school, and then I did my master's program, and then I finished out my last 2 years of PT school. So as far as the additive factor of cost would be, I mean, if you have taken out student loans for your DPT, then obviously the interest on that would be building through deferment. But I did not have to pay for that extra degree. It was something that was covered by the work that I did through my research that I did, as well as through the extra work that I put through with the grant. So if you are looking to add to your body of knowledge, it's definitely a really great way to be able to maybe get a little bit extra in with your program, but you will be adding a year to it. It is a lot of work, but it's really, really fun, especially because I felt like after my first year of PT school, I was basically trying to swim above water. And this year, taking that year off of PT school and really refocusing myself on understanding how research actually works and understanding how to apply research to clinical practice really helped change the way that I think about problems. It made me a better problem solver, a better critical thinker, and it really helped me just understand how, as a clinician, the limitations and the advantages of applying research to your practice. So I think that it made me improve my ability as a clinician, it improved my performance as a PT student, and it improved my performance as a leader within PT school. So it is something that doesn't cost extra, with at least at WashU. Other schools may be different, but it was a good opportunity to be able to add a little bit extra knowledge to my toolbox.
No, that's great. And I think that sounds like a really fantastic add-on to kind of your education with that in there, because I think that's definitely some valuable insight and experience that you've gained. And, you know, Steph, with you and I being relatively newer clinicians, you know, I've got to ask, you know, when you kind of asked before, you just mentioned about going through that first year of PT school and trying to stay above water. You know, kind of looking back on it now, where you're at now, what do you feel are some of the strengths and weaknesses of DPT education in the current mainstream model?
Well, I thought that at WashU, I got a really good education in really being a great problem solver and really being able to critically think through clinical scenarios and problems. And even if it wasn't a type of patient that I hadn't treated before, I had the confidence in my abilities as a clinician to really be able to at least come up with a diagnosis of the patient and identify patterns to help the patient improve. So I'm a firm believer that we as physical therapists should be applying diagnoses to our patients. And whether those diagnoses, so for at WashU, we do movement system impairment diagnoses, but there's a lot of different other ways that you can diagnose people. So if people have learned treatment-based classification system or mechanical diagnosis and treatment or McKinsey, those are all great ways for young clinicians to really classify patients into categories that will help them treat them better and more optimally. And so I'm a big firm believer in diagnoses. And I thought that that was something that WashU did well. And I know that there are other programs that do that. Not all programs are teaching physical therapy diagnoses yet. And that's something that I really hope is adopted throughout the profession. I do think that one thing that we could improve in education is pain science education. I felt like the majority of my pain science education came from one of my clinical rotations, which was at Stanford University at their multidisciplinary orthopedic outpatient center. And a lot of the stuff that I learned there was through what my clinical instructors taught me and what the other physical therapists taught me. But I don't really remember learning a lot about that in school. I know we had a few lectures on it, but again, you learn so much in school that sometimes you miss a few things. And I think that at Rehab Authority, they have done a really good job at helping me continue to grow my understanding about pain science and how important it is in teaching patients about why they have pain and understanding the things that Butler and Mosley are teaching, because those are things that are going to help decrease people's fear of movement and fear of pain and therefore improve their outcomes. And I think a lot of the studies are starting to show that if we can decrease patients' fear of pain and fear of movement, that their outcomes are better. So I would say that I would like to see more programs teach diagnoses in physical therapy, and I would also like to see programs expand on their pain science education, because I do think that that's a very helpful thing to use in all aspects of physical therapy: home health, acute care, outpatient, neurologic patients, pediatrics. I think that it's a really widespread issue that we need to deal with in PT.
Yeah, those are great points, Steph. I think you hit the nail on the head there. I'd like to kind of pivot a little, though, and go a little bit different direction here. You know, and clearly working on public speaking and doing research are some great strategies that will certainly benefit those looking to get involved with teaching. And you do a lot of local, state, national presentations. What would you say are your top tips to give a great presentation to your audience?
So I think that the important thing, especially if you're starting out, is to practice giving presentations to a small audience. Public speaking is the number one fear in America, and a lot of people are really afraid to do it. And it is sometimes a difficult fear to overcome, but the more that you practice, the better you're going to become at it. So even practicing giving presentations in front of your friends or your clinic, or members of your community. And you can do this by teaching them things that you talk about every day in the clinic, whether it be about how to treat low back pain, posture, exercises that you can do to prevent falls, importance for people who are older to, you know, use assistive devices to help them move. Those are all really important things in developing the confidence and decreasing the fear of public speaking. And then I would also say that if you're going to do a lot of public speaking or you want to start, make sure you have somebody that you trust critique your performance. And make sure that it's somebody that's not going to just give you all positive feedback. Critical feedback is just as important as positive feedback in helping you grow as a clinician. If you're interested in speaking nationally, one of the things that I thought about when I was first starting to speak nationally is I was like, well, I'm a new clinician. Why would anybody want to hear me talk? And after talking to some of my colleagues and that, you know, they encouraged me to talk about this knowledge that I have that many other people maybe don't know about, like social media or generational issues, especially with millennials. The advice they gave me was to just go for it. The worst that can happen is that your proposal gets rejected, and then you just get to work on improving it for the next time. So just go for it. Write a proposal. Don't put it together at the last minute. Give yourself time. And then if you're a young speaker, it's really important, I think, to collaborate with more experienced speakers. That way they can show you the ropes. And if you're wanting people to come to your talk, a lot of times pairing yourself up with somebody who's maybe more experienced or a little more popular will get people to come to your talk and therefore give you a bigger audience. So those would be my tips as far as how to start public speaking and then also how to expand your public speaking onto a more national stage. Especially as young grads, or as any physical therapist, if you're really interested in going to a national conference, that's a really expensive thing to do. And one way to decrease the cost of going to conferences is to present. And so that's another really great way to lower your cost as far as going to things like CSM or private practice section, annual conference, or educational leadership conference, or NEXT. Those are all different ways that you can decrease the cost of attending the conference. And a lot of times too, people I think are going to be quite interested in the fact that you are up there actually brave enough to speak in front of all these people, because it is very nerve-wracking. The first time that I presented at a national conference was at the private practice section annual conference. I presented with TJ Janicki out of New Jersey and Craig Johnson out of Minnesota, and we talked about managing millennials. And I remember being, I normally don't get nervous speaking, but I remember being very nervous for that talk just because I knew I was speaking in front of all these very prominent business people. And it was so nice to hear people before and after the talk say, like, wow, you did really great. Your message really resonated with me. And, you know, I had people that I trusted attend the talk and give me good feedback for future presentations. And since then, I've been continually honing my skills as a speaker. I know that I still have work that I can do, but yet I'm really proud of the products that I've delivered as far as speaking goes. And I think that sometimes it's just really hard to actually get the guts to go do something like that. But in the end, you're going to come out a better speaker or a better clinician. And it's a really great way, I think, to market yourself too as a clinician or an educator, to, you know, tell your patients, oh, I'm going to a national conference to speak. They're going to think that that's very impressive.
Yeah, no, I think those are some very important points there. And I think that's very valuable. And, you know, Steph, realizing, of course, that all clinicians are educators to a degree, as, you know, we all educate patients, families, each other. And of course, you know, before we talked about public speaking and kind of research and getting involved with kind of professional organizations. But what other advice would you give to someone looking to become a formal educator in the future? And kind of what would some steps be that they should be doing to go about making that happen?
That's a great question. I think the most important part about becoming a future educator is networking. The Academy of Physical Therapy Education has a breadth of wonderful educators and clinicians that are always willing to help you improve your ability to deliver your message, to help you hone on your ability to teach, to give you advice on the things that you should do to become a good educator. And also, these are going to be the people that potentially could hire you someday. So I think that that's really important, that you find ways to network within PT, whether that be going to APTA conferences, attending your alumni events, whether you're close to the place that you graduated or close to a PT school. I think that that's the number one thing to do is to network. I also think it's important to find your niche. What are you better at than most people? Or what's something unique of that you can deliver to a program or a message that you can deliver to a program that maybe nobody else can deliver it the way that you can? So whether that be being a PD, a lot of programs are looking for neurology clinical specialists or pediatric clinical specialists. So if you can get one of those degree or one of those credentials, that's something that's really going to help you. And I also think it's really important to be passionate because people are really going to want to hear you speak. You know, I know Brandon and Scott, you probably can relate to the days of sitting in the classroom listening to professors talk, and with everything that you learn, I'm sure you can identify the professors that you really enjoyed listening to teach and those that maybe you didn't listen to as much because their message was maybe a little more monotone. But if you can be really passionate about what you're teaching, a lot of times it's going to inspire students and inspire faculty or other people in the profession to want you to be there to help them teach. And then, of course, about 50% of faculty members nowadays in different programs need to have PhDs. And so your chances of getting hired are a lot higher if you get a PhD or some type of advanced doctorate degree, which I know, Scott, you're doing right now. So that is definitely something that's really helpful. And I think that a lot of the more prestigious programs in PT are really encouraging their new faculty members to pursue those. And many times, if you come on as a clinical faculty, they'll give you opportunities to still pursue your PhD while teaching full time, which is busy, but definitely a necessity.
Yeah, those are some great points, Steph. I think, in all honesty, we're going to have a shortage of terminal degrees in the upcoming years because we've got, you know, something like 50 DPT programs about to be started and another 50 in the like wings getting ready to go through their accreditation process. So, you know, we're at 220 some odd programs right now, add another 100 in the next year or two. I mean, you know, I just don't see us having enough terminal degrees to meet that 50% mark, but I guess we'll just have to kind of wait and see what happens.
Right. Well, and I think that the terminal degree is an important one because of how you learn to really critically think through the literature and to make sure that you're understanding research methodology in a way that you can teach to others. And, you know, by all means, just because a person has a PhD does not make them an expert teacher, but I think it helps a lot. And I definitely encourage those who really do want to become educators to potentially think about getting some type of advanced degree in that sense, because I think that it'll make you more marketable and it'll also help you be able to communicate with students and with other faculty members within the programs that you want to teach in a way that will help develop the physical therapy students that we need that will critically think through problems, be able to diagnose their patients, and be able to really understand and deliver evidence-based interventions.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting thought. And I guess, I mean, I agree with kind of both of the comments you guys are saying. The only thing I'm most worried about is, you know, with the debt that currently DPT students are going through, I'm just really worried about cost. And are we going to get people that want to get into that? Because, you know, it's just so financially constraining.
I think you make a really great point, Brandon, that the cost of education is definitely a problem. And we've heard with a lot of the guests that we've interviewed that that's what they think is the number one problem in PT education. And I think that this is where we need to get creative. I think that medical school does this well. They have a government funded program that allows medical students to get their MD PhD and they don't have to pay for their MD. Unfortunately, as far as I know, there's no nationally funded PhD physical DPT program. I know that there are programs that do offer the dual PT PhD degree. As far as I know, I don't know if there's any outside funding for that, but I could be wrong about that. I know that that is something that's been really new within the profession. But I think cost is a big concern. If we could do a PT PhD, which if you did both degrees, that it would be funded by the university through maybe some additional teaching duties or additional research duties. I think that that would help solve that problem. And I think it would also help improve the cost of education and encourage more students to get those PTD or those PhDs, which we know are very much needed. So I'm a huge advocate for the development and continuation of PT PhD programs. I also think that this is where advocacy comes in. We need to be advocating for federal funding for this in order to improve our profession and improve patient care. I think that it's great to have clinical faculty on staff. You need to make sure that you have really strong clinicians teaching the clinical content. But I also think that if you are an active clinician and you have that terminal degree, you may be able to offer something a little bit different than somebody who's maybe just teaching the theory aspect of the program or just teaching the clinical aspect of the program. And I think it would help solve the shortage problem that you were talking about earlier, Scott. So I think that that'd be a solution that I would implement if I were a director of a PT program.
What have you learned about the political action and advocacy arena when it comes to PT throughout your career thus far?
Well, one of the things that I've really learned is that we as physical therapists can't do our job in treating patients if the laws aren't there to make sure that we are able to help our patients. So, for example, the therapy cap was just repealed. However, now there is a new rule that reduces the payment of PTAs and OTAs if they're treating Medicare patients, and this is going to be implemented around 2020. And this is something that, especially in rural areas, will negatively affect our patients because a lot of physical therapists don't work in rural areas because they don't want to, or there's just not enough physical therapists to meet that demand. And so you have to rely on PTAs. Well, now if you have that PTA working for a private practice or working for a hospital or working for a skilled nursing facility, the chances of that facility being paid for the services of that PTA is going to be a lot less. And this is something that if we're going to change this, we have to advocate for it because it is about our patients. It is not about us as professionals. It is not about us protecting our scope of practice. It is about making sure that we are helping to lower healthcare costs and we're helping people have access to our services. So that's one thing that I like, that I want people to remember is if you're not into wanting to advocate yourself, then the next avenue would be to become an APTA member. As APTA members, our dues pay professionals to advocate on our behalf and on our patients' behalf. And so even if you're not directly advocating for your patients by calling your legislature or writing a letter or and informing patients about laws that are potentially going to affect them, you're at least contributing to professionals within our professional organization to advocate for them. And if you donate to political campaigns, you have the power to actually influence candidates in both parties. And some of the greatest advice that I got about becoming more politically involved was from Eva Norman, who's very, very active in APTA from out of Minnesota. And she told me that the best way to really make sure that you're making an impact, both sides, Republican and Democrat, is to make sure that you're stretching your donations evenly. Of course, you want to donate to people that you believe in, who you think are going to help you. But it's also, I think, important to make sure that you're keeping your contributions even so that when somebody, a Republican or a Democrat, goes back and looks at your donation record, which is public, they can see that it's not necessarily a party affiliation that you're donating to. It's based on, do they support improved services to healthcare for their constituents? So that's something else that I would say. The other thing I would say about becoming involved in advocacy is it's all about relationships. Forming a relationship with your lawmaker or with their office staff is really important because they're going to be the ones that will call you when issues regarding healthcare and physical therapy arrive in their house or in the House or in the Senate. So this, I think that we've done a really good job at Rehab Authority establishing relationships with our legislatures in that you know, Amy, our Senator Amy Klobuchar, who's very, very involved in fighting the opioid epidemic, calls us regularly to ask us to participate in different panels, as well as to invite people to figure out who they should invite to these opioid panels. We've also formed really good relationships with our local lawmakers, which allowed me to pursue this disability parking statute for Minnesota that I talked about earlier. And actually, our local lawmaker, Deb Keel, ended up sponsoring that and pushing that forward. And so if you have a really good relationship with a lawmaker, a lot of times they are going to want to help you so that they can help their constituents. Most people that go into politics actually genuinely do want to help their constituents. And if you can form that relationship and be honest with them, then a lot of times you're going to be the one that they will call. Eva also gave me some really great advice as to if you are wanting to maybe campaign for somebody, it's really important that you're honest with that person about your political beliefs. You may not agree with them on everything, but if they have shown support for your issue as far as healthcare goes, then this is something that is important to you. And it's really important that when you're advocating, you're always making it about the patient, not about you as the physical therapist. Because in the end, it's about how can we lower healthcare costs? How can we make sure that people have good access to physical therapy services so that we can achieve the triple aim and decrease healthcare costs?
Wow. Yeah, I think those are some absolutely gold points there. And, you know, and something I'm going to ask you kind of a question off the script here, because I'm just really curious, you know, from what you've been through with advocacy and stuff, what are some of the most interesting and uncommon things that you don't think most PTs are aware of regarding advocacy in the process?
That's a great question. I think that a lot of times people are very jaded about politics, especially in today's kind of climate. And so I think that a lot of times people don't really think that their legislator actually cares about what they say, or about they don't think that their voice really matters. And I think that that is something that I have found is not true. I have heard from a lot of my colleagues, as well as personal experience myself, is that if you form a really good relationship with that person, they care more about what you say than about what any other health professional will say, because they see you as their friend and they see you as an expert in that field. And so I think a lot of people think, well, I don't really want to call my senator, or calling my senator is not really going to make a difference. And it really does, especially when you have a bunch of physical therapists on the same day or at the same time or around the same time that a bill is coming out, calling offices, and they're getting these calls from all these PTs, from all of their patients, from their family members, and they're really realizing that this is a huge issue. They are going to listen to you, especially if you have a mass of people joining in the call. And so I think that that's something that maybe people don't necessarily think happens, and it definitely does happen. And you know, at the last minute, when it comes down to things, unfortunately, whoever has the most money is the one that gets their way. And we've seen this multiple times in politics, where something's going to go through, but then, you know, an organization or a special interest group with more money that donates to more campaigns or more leadership, in the end, they're the ones whose policy gets chosen over, let's say, our policy, because we don't have as much of a power as far as money goes than another organization. And this is what makes the American Medical Association so powerful. And this is what makes chiropractors so powerful nationally and locally, is that they donate a lot to their PAC and they donate a lot to political campaigns. And that's where the money is where the power is. And so I really do encourage people, even if you are an APTA member, do donate even $5 to the PT PAC, because this can make a huge difference as to whether something that we want to pass passes, or if a bill that we don't want to pass passes.
Yeah, I think that definitely shed some light on things. And, you know, Steph, I know we recently talked about kind of the cost of terminal degrees as being one barrier to teaching in an academic setting, but, you know, are there any other unique barriers that potential academic educators face that also contribute to people not pursuing teaching in academia in general?
I think time is a really big factor. Being able to have the building the credentials that maybe you need in order to become an educator can be time consuming, as well as usually educators have a lot on their plate. So faculty members are not just teaching one or two courses, but they're teaching, you know, multiple courses within the curriculum. They're the ACC, or they're the head of clinical education. They're on a bunch of academic committees within the organization. They're doing research. They're working in the clinic. So I mean, they have a lot of different hats they're worn, and so time is definitely an issue. I also think that the specialty requirements may be an issue. So I mean, we talked previously about, you know, the advanced degree, but not only getting a PhD, but maybe you need your OCS to teach, or your PCS, or maybe you need a specific certification in order to teach. I think that those are some barriers that people run into. And then finally, if you don't have the network to get you into the door, a lot of times it's really difficult to get into those educational realms. So it's really important, I think, again, that networking piece and making sure that you're connected to people who are in charge of these programs or who are teaching at these programs and making your interests known to them. Those would be some of the barriers that I would say may arise.
Yeah, that's a good point, Steph. And, you know, you've obviously come to know this final wrap-up question, but we ask all the guests this. If you could change one aspect of DPT education, which aspect would you change and how would you go about changing?
Well, I'm going to go with a little bit different answer that I haven't heard many people say on our show. And that's off of Chad Cook's Sarasoli lecture that he gave at CSM in 2007. And I think that we need to admit more students based on their leadership potential and not just solely based on their grades or their GRE scores. I think that we do need to have more leaders in the profession of physical therapy, people who are going to be movers and shakers, that are going to really be passionate about helping to move the profession forward and not just satisfied with just being a mediocre clinician. I think that we need to make sure that we're somehow scoring people based on some of these things that Chad Cook talked about in his lecture, whether it be leadership style, networking ability, emotional intelligence. That's a common word that we've been hearing at different conferences. These are all important skills that not only make us great PTs, but make us great healthcare providers and leaders within healthcare. And that's what I think we need to do as physical therapists, is we need to lead healthcare. There's still a lot of people that don't know what physical therapists do. There's still a lot of physicians that don't understand why physical therapy is important. And there are still institutions that look at physical therapy as lower on the totem pole. And I just don't think that that's tolerated. And I think that if we have more people that are striving to be leaders within healthcare, and we're selecting for those things, that we'll be able to really hit on APTA's vision statement of transforming society.
No, I think that's a very important message to hear, and I very much agree with kind of the points that you're saying there. You know, Steph, as always, thanks for joining us with everything and such, and you know, it's a pleasure again to have you with us. And you know, for our audience perhaps who kind of wants to find you online and on social media, where's the best place they could go about finding you?
Well, I am on Twitter. My Twitter handle is TheSteph21. That's probably the social media site that I'm most active on. But you can also find me on Facebook and LinkedIn under Stephanie Wyrock. I also am on there. And then I just want to make a quick pitch for a mini series that I will be doing in the future. I'm not exactly sure of the date yet, but if you listeners want to keep your eye out for this, I will be doing a mini series on advocacy. I'm going to bring in three really prominent people within the healthcare field. They're not all going to be physical therapists. Who are going to talk about advocacy and how you can get involved at a small to a large scale. So not everybody has to be going to the Capitol every year and talking to their senator, but even the advocacy that we do with our patients is important. And we'll talk about that. So just be looking for stuff on our social media pages about that mini series, because that will be coming to you sometime this summer.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that, Steph. And thanks again for your time. We really enjoyed talking with you tonight on the guest side of things, and looking forward to having you as the co-host for the rest of them.
Thanks, guys. I'm really excited to continue co-hosting with you. And I just love what this podcast is all about. We are going to help change education and hopefully get other people's messages out there, because I think in order for us to have this cohesive message and come together as physical therapists, we need to make sure that we are coming together on a common ground. And I think you guys are doing a really great job with that.
Well, we've had an amazing team throughout the whole process, including everyone on this call. So I think everyone's definitely got a proud role in kind of this thing. But again, Steph, thanks again. Always a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you for attending class today, and we hope that you learned something and gained value from the content.
If you'd like to schedule office hours with us, feel free to add us on Twitter at HET Podcast, on Instagram, HET Podcast, on Facebook, The Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast, and the homepage, healthcareeducationtransformationpodcast.com.
And for those of you following along in the syllabus, extra credit can be obtained by liking us, sharing us, and leaving a review.
Let's continue our journey up Mount Educational Success as lifelong learners.